get the thoughts of our good colleague and friend Beth Ann Nichols, Golf Week magazine. You were there. From your perspective, Beth Ann, how did this decision play out?
I got to tell you, confusion ruled the day all the way around from start to finish. You know, when I got word on Saturday evening that they were going to start at 10 o'clock, I literally said LOL to the LPGA official who texted me that. Like, the temperature are going to be freezing. It's going to be 30 degrees at 10 o'clock. How can the course possibly be ready? So that they put that out there as a start time was their first mistake. So I don't disagree with players that it wasn't good at 10 o'clock. You know, when balls are bouncing on the green and you know, and it's frozen on the outside. You know, Marty Fish said it felt like he was walking on concrete when he walked across the practice putting green. I understand. But at noon, when it's 40 degrees and Annika Sorenstam, who's playing in the celebrity division, has just finished nine holes, and she turns to her playing partner and says, we could play nine more. You know, the conditions are fine. It's very playable. You have to wonder, you know, if Jack Wagner's out there in his mid-60s shooting 200 par on the back nine, why aren't these conditions good enough for LPGA players?
That's really the key here, Beth Ann. You've seen when you have a 66-year-old guy able to shoot 200 par for nine holes, and the LPGA Tour is suggesting that somehow these conditions aren't good enough for the best women in the world, it leaves the taste of an unserious organization that's attempting to not embarrass its players rather than actually deliver a product for its fans or for its sponsors or for its broadcasters. Is that an unfair assessment of how this is playing out?
Absolutely not, you know, and I think that the fact that the tour never could really come through with some concrete reasoning behind their decisions was, you know, made the situation even worse. You know, I mean, at 10 o'clock when you send out celebrities, you know, the very few media on site are automatically saying, well, why aren't the LPGA players competing? And it took them an hour to come back in and tell us that they weren't optimal competitive, that it wasn't an optimal competitive environment for LPGA players. Well, what does that mean? And what are the factors that it takes for it to be optimal? And they couldn't answer that question. And they never really did answer that question. So, you know, when it comes to the end of the day and they decide to cancel the final round, it's like, well, hold on. Right now it's 50 degrees and sunny in Orlando as we sit here and speak. Why aren't they playing on Monday? It's like, well, the conditions, you know, are going to be very similar to what they were on Sunday. So we didn't think we'd be able to complete, you know, 72 holes. It's like, well, we don't understand why you're not playing today, let alone tomorrow. It's never really, you know, laid out for anyone. And you know, one of the players actually joked to me on the range when right after this decision came down around 12:30 that they were going to cut it to 54 holes. She said, well, what about in China when we didn't have any grass on the greens? Those weren't exactly optimal conditions, you know? So, you know, thankfully the LPGA has a leadership summit this week because they have a lot to talk about.
Yeah, this will be topic A, B, and C, Beth Ann. Listen, there was so much optimism about this season opener, new commissioner, more cameras, coverage of every round. How bad is this? How much of a rocky start is this season opener when so many people are excited and paying attention?
You know, absolutely. I mean, we were robbed of the opportunity to watch Nelly Korda, you know, follow that spectacular 64 with, you know, really grinding it out and show us, you know, that grit that she has. You know, can she hold on? You know, what's the drama going to be unfolding? And even if it didn't finish, you know, live on network television, you know, on Sunday, the fact that it could spill over today and we could have some fabulous Monday golf would have been great. And so, you know, the fact that we didn't hear from Craig Kesler throughout this whole ordeal, that there were just statements that went out without any names attached was very disappointing. The fact that the media, you know, didn't have a rules official come into the tent to explain to us what was going on with the conditions that made them unplayable for LPGA players. Ricky Lasky, you know, went into the booth and obviously talked with Grant Boone, but she didn't come in and meet with the media. I think these are big mistakes. It felt so much like the Solheim Cup from the standpoint of everybody went in a room and they hid and nobody gave us any explanations. And when you have that kind of void, unfortunately, people start filling that void with their own theories of why the LPGA players aren't playing. And it's not pretty out there on Twitter.
Yeah, it seems, Bethan, that everything the LPGA Tour could possibly have gotten wrong, they did actually manage to get wrong. You know, this idea of the optimal competitive environment, whatever that gobbledygook nonsense actually means, I don't know if anybody can actually explain that. The idea that they're not even playing on Monday when the next LPGA event isn't until February 19th. So it's not as though anyone had to rush any. For Norg, will hurdle stuff if there's credit to be taken in front of a TV camera to suddenly disappear and send out anonymous statements on the Sunday. Did Craig Kessler just screw this up? Is this a black eye for him early in his tenure as the commissioner?
I mean, I don't see how you can look at it any other way. I think the honeymoon period has ended abruptly. And I think, you know, given what we saw transpire at the Solheim Cup with the bus debacle and the way they handled that crisis, I don't think it's unfair to say that the tour should bring in a crisis management consultant and from top to bottom, you know, look at how this all unfolded and how they could handle this differently next time, because there's going to be another situation like this. And it doesn't have to spin out of control into such this, you know, an enormous disaster. So, you know, I hope that there are some lessons learned, because I think that's probably the most disappointing thing, is that this isn't a one-off. This happens no matter who's in charge. And so, you know, there has to be some systemic changes at the LPGA. And I understand that it's still early in Craig Kessler's tenure and he doesn't want to lose the locker room. I get that. But I also think that there were players who were, you know, saying it's not playable at 10, who I don't think felt that way at 12 or 1, and didn't think that Monday was then going to be off the table. So, you know, even if there are some loud voices in the room saying, you know, we don't think we want to play, I think the commissioner has to sort of rise above that and realize that, you know, this is a serious organization, and how many other leagues, from junior golf to college golf to professional golf, would be playing more golf on Sunday and still be playing today.
Yeah, on the LPGA website, they don't even call the players players. They're called athletes on the leaderboard. And it's a shame we were robbed of seeing those athletes compete on Sunday in Orlando. Bethan, we appreciate a few minutes, and hopefully it gets better in that leadership summit. Can't wait to hear the results from that. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
And here is the bio of Parker McLaughlin. 164 starts on tour, won the 2008 Reno Open on the PGA Tour. Parker, it's always good to see you. I have not yet fired or hired you in 2026, but the week is pretty young at this point. When you look at this golf course, you've played here as a competitor. You see these guys out here year after year. What are the short game challenges of trying to get it done on this particular golf course?
Yeah, I think it's fun because you can kind of see a lot of the runoffs are cut really tight. And with the weather that we're going to see this week, the greens are going to be firm. So guys are going to have to either choose to go up off these tight lies and get the ball to stop, or they're going to have to try to bump it into some of these upslopes. And it gets a little tricky with the rye grass. It can kind of be sticky sometimes. You know, it's very similar to Augusta when you look at some of the shots, like 15 over the green at Augusta. Guys are having to bump it in there, and sometimes it gets stuck in that grass, and then sometimes it goes too far. A lot of the same characteristics here.
16, of course, is the star of the show. As you probably heard, it led the nightly news last night. I'm going to be hitting a tee shot here at the end of the show. What's your approach to playing this hole, which is something you've done in competition?
It is a nerve-wracking hole. I'm not going to lie. You think about it when you're warming up, very similar to 17 at Sawgrass. I remember, for me, my greatest memory of this hole was a Friday afternoon. It was cold and windy, and a lot of times these guys are hitting wedges. I was hitting a 6-iron, back left pin. The wind was blowing into us, and it was late Friday afternoon. I hit this 6-iron to 6 feet. The crowd went nuts, and my sponsor at the time, Oakley, they had stuffed my bag full of Oakley sunglasses, and I'm throwing them out to everybody, right? So now they haven't seen a great shot in hours. I hit it to 6 feet. They're chanting my name going all the way up. I get up there. I miss the putt. They booed me all the way to 17.
Oh, no.
All the way. They didn't stop until I got into 17T. So they can be amazing here, but they can also be pretty ruthless. But it's a fun atmosphere.
It's amazing how quickly you can go from being the pigeon to being the statue around here, isn't it? How differently do tour players approach the short game in your experience? You've worked with a lot of guys over the last few years. Do they have radically different approaches of how they assess and work on the short game?
Yeah, I think so. I think that a lot of it depends on where you grew up. Where you grew up dictates if you see the ball coming out low or a little bit higher. And that then bleeds into your technique. And so then you just sort of look at these guys and you're like, this guy likes to, he prefers it a little higher. He prefers to throw it like a beanbag. Other guys like to fire it in a little bit lower with spin. So you're kind of looking at both situations and you're trying to figure out your player, what their comfortability is. It's just like a guy standing up saying, I love to cut it. And it's like, I'm not going to go and teach this guy and be like, we're just going to hit hooks. Like that's we're not going
to try
to
change them based on what their sort of base DNA is you're working with. You wouldn't try to adjust them too far away.
You adjust it a little bit, but I'm not going to go and take somebody that's like, he loves to go super low and be like, we're just going to toss beanbags, or someone that just tosses beanbags and say, we're only going to hit it low with a bunch of spin. You try to find that neutral middle ground because you sort of need all the shots out here. You need the low one, you need the mid one, you need the high one. And you have to have your sort of recipes as to how you execute all those shots. But it's good to have a baseline.
Well, you've worked with the best players in the world, but you've also worked with high handicappers. You did a great piece in Golf Magazine with Zephyr Melton. You had him with a 5-iron, 7-iron, 9-iron, and wedge. And you said that he needed to use his body more as the engine, almost more like a putting stroke. Can you just talk about why that's so important for those that may get a little flippy with the hands, for example?
Yeah, I mean, I always equate it to, you know, how many times, Amy, and I know I'm going to put you on the spot here. How many times have you ever legitimately chunked a putt? How many times have you laid sod over a putt?
I've lost several balls with a putter in my time, which is a statistical improbability as well. So I think I could say
you've actually chunked a putt.
I have a couple times.
Like actually chunked it, like taking a divot out of the green.
Not often.
Well, usually from a distance, like if it's like a 70-foot putt and you know, body gets all out of whack.
I've never taken a divot from the green. You've actually taken a divot
from the green?
That's why he's here. He's the short game chef. Yes, I have. I'm putting myself out there. We have bigger issues. I'm not saying it's like every 18 holes. We once or twice a year. I got a big putt early in the season, Parker.
Okay, from 20 feet, have you ever taken a chunk out of the green?
No, I haven't.
Okay,
no.
So what we would do is take that back into your chipping stroke.
Okay,
right. So we're not in putting. Our knees are fairly quiet, so that's where we would start. So we understand where the bottom of the arc is.
Right.
And so we take it back and we go, okay, let's take one step off the green. Use your putter. Okay, now let's use a 5-iron one step off the green. See if we can make a similar stroke and just let the ball go. The second people get loft in their hands, everything
struggles.
It becomes struggle bus.
Knee dips. You know, Correct. The knee dip, try to save it. I mean, there's an epidemic of people struggling. I mean, have you fixed people with the yips?
Oh, hundreds.
Really?
Yes, hundreds. Yes, it really does. It really does start with the philosophy that I think that the putting stroke is a cousin to the chip shot, the bump and run shot.
Okay,
and then the bump and run shot is a cousin to the pitch shot. When you start to go into other areas of short game, like if you're hitting a shot from the bunker, trying to hit a flop shot, or trying to hit a shot out of thick rough, that's like a completely different family.
Okay,
right? It's way more set, way more release.
Yeah,
but if you're making a putting stroke, that's not that dissimilar to hitting a 5-iron, 7-iron, 9-iron gap wedge as a bump and run type of a shot. They're very, very similar.
How much time should a recreational golfer actually put as a percentage of their practice routine? How much should a chap like him be working on the short game versus trying to hit drivers all day long?
I think if you just dedicated 10 to 15 minutes a day, like literally, and just did that drill that you saw that I did with Zephyr.
Yes.
If you did that drill, 3 balls with a 5-iron, 7-iron, 9-iron gap wedge.
Yeah.
If you did that for 10 minutes, you would immediately start to get better in 2 weeks' time.
What should he do whenever he actually misses this green when he's aiming for it later? What should his short game shot be then?
7-iron, you think? 9-iron?
It always,
chunk a putter?
That's the thing. It always depends on the lie and then the terrain between you and the pin.
Yeah.
I mean, we saw yesterday Justin Rose, and he's done it. He did it at Pebble Beach as well. He used a 7-wood. Right?
Yeah.
Just off the green there.
Yeah.
He used a 7-wood. It's like
Todd Hamilton.
Absolutely.
Hybrid. On the way to winning the Open in 2004.
There's so many ways to play shots around the green, and the lie, it's sort of like a decision tree. The lie dictates what you're going to play.
Yes.
And then, okay, well, do you only have about this far between the edge of the green and the pin? Well, then you might need to go up high. Okay. Or if you've got a long distance, you can play one a little lower. And then the club choice plays into it, right? Are you going to play it with your 60 degree or are you going to play it with a 7-iron?
Yeah.
There's so many options. I think that's what I love about short game is there's so many different options and so many different ways to play shots. I mean, at the end of the day, we're just trying to get the ball close to the hole, not have a double chip, right? Like, that's what we're trying to do.
Can't believe I admitted I chunked a putt on national television. But I'm planning on hitting this green in regulation a little more than an hour from now. Thank you, Parker.
I believe in you.
Thank you. Great to have Parker McLaughlin with us.
Now, one man who's been to 40 Phoenix Opens over the years, all the way back to the 1970s. Joe Passoff is a golf course architecture scholar, an author. He's played or toured over 1,800 golf courses around the world. He's also had the dubious pleasure of maybe 100 rounds in my company over the years. So Joe has seen the darkness descend in daylight out there. Joe, it's great to see you again for our annual visit here. You've spent, and you've written quite recently, about Tom Weisskopf, the architect of this golf course. You knew him well. You spent a lot of time with him over the years. What would you say are the sort of baseline guiding principles of Tom Weisskopf as an architect?
Eamon, Damon, thanks for having me. I think what you have to come back to is what he stated and said, I had enough controversy as a player. I don't need that as an architect. And that kind of guided everything he did in tandem with Jay Morish and then as a solo designer to say, I'm not going to make any outrageous statements. I want the people who play my golf courses to have fun and to have options. That's what guided him with every private, public, municipal, whatever he did.
How underappreciated is he as an architect in terms of how much of a student of the craft that he was?
He loved this stuff. This was not a guy coming around and collecting a check to lend his name to something. He started off 1984, basically, and he told me he was in a bad place. He just was uncomfortable with where he was as a person, as a player, what was going to go on. And he was given an opportunity to design a golf course, private club as it turned out, Troon Country Club out here. And he fell in love with the whole process. Just changed his life. And it helped that Troon Country Club was very well received. Best new private course of the year for 1986. And it just gave him that much more impetus to stay the course with how he felt the design had come off. We know him a lot better for introducing or reintroducing the drivable par four, but it was a playability aspect that pervaded throughout his designs in 35 plus years.
Let's talk about this golf course specifically. Obviously, this hole behind us gets a lot of attention, but there are other holes on this golf course that you think actually are really good representatives of that kind of interesting, playable, fun golf that Tom Weisskopf pursued.
Well, there's a couple of holes out here in particular. I mean, he loved, as I said, risk-reward. It doesn't always come into play. You've got to have your meat and potatoes par fours that challenge the best. But where possible, he liked to give an avenue for the lesser player, higher handicaps, and still challenge the really good player. I can point to one underrated hole on the back nine. That would be the 12th, the par three 12th. And if we look at this hole, you're talking about a modest carry, especially from an upper tee. And you see what's in front of the green? Nothing except grass. Okay? Now, for a 15 handicap who just wants to bunt the ball, that's doable. I can make a par or at worst a bogey by doing just that. But for the good player with four different quadrants on the hole locations, you can see bogeys and double bogeys by the bucketful.
Same could be said for 17, maybe the second most famous hole here on this golf course.
Well, he designed more than 70 golf courses with at least one drivable par four on every one. He said this is his favorite of all of them. And here's what's going on. You get to the green, water left, but a deep swale to the right. So no matter what's going on with the hole location, there's some interesting problem that needs to be solved. That's what made 17 so wonderful.
And we have, let's go back a few years, Ricky Fowler is one of the guys who's created some memories on this golf hole.
Oh, boy. So you think he's hit a perfect golf shot, and there it goes. It's just tugged a tiny bit, just enough to go into the water. Now, 40% of the players that hit into the water still make par, so it's doable. And this young man, Sahith Theegala, in 2022, hitting a two hybrid. And, oh, was this unlucky. Just a low enough trajectory to hit the downslope and go all the way through the green. He was tied for the lead at that point and finds the water.
From tragedies there, we've also seen some triumph as well. You go back 5 years, Brooks Koepka was in the thick of it when he came to this hole, and he walked away with a lot happier look on his face than we've seen from either of those guys.
Unusual Sunday hole location, back right as opposed to back left, but yeah, Brooks, a previous champion here, going to be a champion again with that 98-foot pitch shot.
His ninth career PGA Tour win, eighth career PGA Tour win. Joe, I'm curious, there's a story that you tell of spending time with Tom Weisskopf here. I believe it was the 13th hole, and he got on the ground? Am I wrong or am I right about this?
No, he did.
Okay.
Architects use the paint gun to signify where they want a design element going, layout, a bunker or hazard or water. And he wanted this little coffin bunker like they have at the old course at St. Andrews. And to indicate to the crew what he meant in terms of size and depth, he laid down in it and looked up at the sky and did one of these and said, yeah, if you're in this coffin bunker, you're dead.
Wow. One of the great characters in the game and one of the great architects in the game. We always feel smarter when you join us on this set, Joe.
All right. That's dubious, but I thank you anyway.
Real quick, any advice for me? I'm about to hit this shot on 16. Any advice for me?
I love the butter cut.
Okay. Thank you. Say no more. Let's keep it simple. I don't need too many swing thoughts before.
I played with him yesterday. I would not be taking advice from him.
Oh, no. Joe, an expert in golf around the country, but especially here in Arizona. And speaking of guys who love Arizona, who live in Arizona, yeah, how about an Open champ? Former world number one, a Ryder Cup captain, Tom Lehman will join us just after the break. Great to have Tom Lehman with us on our set, high above 16. Always great to see you. What do you remember about the year 2000 and that win? You got to have thick skin to win around here.
Yeah, yes, you do. You know, just ask Hal Sutton. Hal made the mistake of criticizing the fans here on Saturday night that year, and he heard all about it on Sunday morning. Okay, when he went around the golf course, he got booed the whole way around. And wow. It's a tough crew. I've always said this is the perfect spot for a Ryder Cup. You know, the golf course sets up beautifully for match play. It's very risk-reward. The fans, obviously, are phenomenal. And I would say they're mostly respectful, but they like to have their fun, you know. And it all started with the college kids on the back of this tee right here at the TGI Fridays tent, you know, back in the early 90s. And now we have this right here.
When you look back at your win 26 years ago, and you've played here a long time, Tom, just how radically has this tournament, much even less this hole, but how radically has this tournament changed over time?
Well, I think the thing I would say that probably says it all is there was a few years when I was doing the pregame show with Brandel and Aaron and the guys, and we did a stat check. And so I said, I think you ought to do a stat check on the front nine scoring versus the back nine scoring and see how it's changed over the years. And sure enough, the front nine was always a shot harder than the back nine. Okay, and then starting kind of when this place kind of went crazy and exploded, it's totally shifted. Now the back nine is over a shot harder than the front nine. Wow. You know, and so what's the explanation for that? And of course, they have changed the course a little bit, but not that much. You know, and I really do think that the reason for that is this back nine gets really chaotic, and you have to be really tough mentally, and you have to really be able to focus on what you're doing because there's so many distractions. And, you know, some love it, some don't.
Did you embrace it or did you tolerate it? I mean, where's the line for how you...
Well, I lived here, so I loved it. You know, I got a lot of love here.
Yeah.
You know, I hit a lot of good shots on this, so I didn't get booed a whole lot. You know, but you get to a hole like this, and it was always that thing, are you going to rise to the occasion or are you going to kind of wilt? You know, don't wilt. Okay.
No, I'm not going to wilt.
Okay, don't wilt. You know, so are you going to rise and hit a great shot, or are you going to play fearfully and do something stupid and hear the boos? So that's kind of the way the whole back nine plays.
You have this kind of everyman persona. Golf fans really connected with you. I think it's part because your journey to the big stage. You once told me this story of playing on the mini tours at a place called like the K-Fire in the Dakotas. You said it was so hot that you had to make the decision to sleep in your car with the windows up and to keep the mosquitoes out, but you might not wake up in the morning.
That's very true. No, it was. I was a college kid. You know, in the K-Fire Classic, it was in, I think, Bismarck, North Dakota. I had no money, you know, and so I drove out there to play, and I'll just sleep in my car. But it was 90 degrees and humid, and there was bugs. And so it was either leave the windows open and get chewed alive, or roll the windows up and then stink like crazy the next morning. And I chose the latter, you know. But yeah, that's the way the game was kind of played back then. You know, the kids who played college golf and then into the mini tours trying to get on the tour, they, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of opportunity. You had to just grind and fight. You weren't making any money. So you just kind of did what you had to do.
When you see the chatter about the various concepts that may come out in the next few months about how the tour is going to change, perhaps it's fewer events, maybe it's narrower pathways, considering your experience coming into the game, Dom, and how much you relied on those pathways to fight your way through, does that concern you at all that maybe it's just getting a little bit too for-profit and losing sight of what it has been?
Yeah, I think that's, again, I don't know all the details of everything, but it certainly seems to me that the contracting goes straight along with the for-profit portion of the tour these days and how it's changed. I mean, it's been a you know, glacial shift of everything over the last, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 years. Things are far, far different than they used to be. I've always been a proponent of opening things up the most you can and getting the most competition possible. And let the best man win, you know, just so it just, you know, historically, I've always been on the other end of that extreme where the tour is going. But, you know, we'll wait and see what happens. But I believe in opportunity. You know, I believe in, you know, get out there, improve yourself and see who's the best.
Part and parcel with that is the discussion of maybe contracting the schedule and getting out of the shadow of the National Football League when they're finishing the regular season and starting their playoffs. As a player, height of power, did you feel that you were overshadowed? Did you feel like, hey, we had plenty of people watching in January and February?
Yeah, I didn't care. I didn't care. I mean, if there was an NFL game on it, it didn't affect me at all. Yeah. You know, I'd rather be out here competing. And so maybe the TV ratings and all the things that go with it made it more difficult for the title sponsors or the tour itself, but it didn't really affect my mindset at all. It was a long schedule. I mean, it was a 10 month schedule for certain, you know, maybe a little bit longer sometimes. And it is a long schedule. I can see making it shorter, but not to avoid football.
Mm. Now that we're in this for-profit era, Tom, and obviously the tour has investors, those investors will look at things that work. This is a week that works. And those investors probably know right down to the units of beer that are sold here, the extent to which it works. But is this portable? Would this kind of setup work as well with, say, the Travelers in Connecticut or the Colonial at Fort Worth? Or is it so ingrained here?
Well, I think that if you do the demographics on who comes, you know, it's not just people who live here. I mean, there's a huge volume of people who are down here for a week, a month, 3 months, you know, who come into town and then they leave again. And a lot of folks who come to this tournament are those folks who are coming down here to have some fun, to play golf, to enjoy the weather. And so it goes beyond just Scottsdale residents or Phoenix residents. And I don't know if any other place in the country, you know, has the same type situation. I don't know that you could do this anywhere. I know that we got the idea from a few places which had a lot of fun on a hole, like the 17th hole at Greensboro or the 17th hole at Milwaukee, where they really kind of did it right on those one holes. And, you know, but look what's happened here in Scottsdale. And I think it's tough to replicate.
I remember seeing you at the Ryder Cup and seeing Corey Pavin, a fellow UCLA Bruin like myself, walking inside the ropes. And I thought to myself, wow, there's so much institutional knowledge just between the two of you. I'm curious how connected you are and feel to the young players or to the tour itself. Do they lean on you? Do executives lean on you? Do players lean on you? Or do you feel almost removed from the modern PGA Tour?
Not removed, no. I would say just, in fact, that the young guys, who I happen to think are remarkable golfers and for the most part, remarkable people, they very much embrace guys of my generation. Always respectful, always kind, always welcoming, always act like they're happy to see you. The tour itself, you know, that's a different story. It's, you know, they do their thing and they don't need guys like us weighing in. They have their own agenda. You know, but the players themselves, I really I admire and respect those guys a lot.
I want to go back to something you said earlier in this conversation, Tom. And it's a popular sentiment here that this would be an ideal Ryder Cup venue, not just because of what Tom Weisskopf left in terms of the strategy of the course, but because of the crowd engagement. The crowd engagement this year at Bethpage struck a lot of people as just crass, vulgar, way over the line in terms of the abuse. Did you watch that? What was your reaction? Because you were, in a way, Ryder Cup captain in Dublin. And that crowd was pretty loud.
Yeah, and you hear all kinds of things. So it's not like you go to Europe and you don't hear some idiotic things. You do. But I think the words you used, crass and the waiting till Rory got over the putt and then letting out an F-bomb. I mean, that it was embarrassing to me. It really was. I was very embarrassed for our team, for our country, because that is a line that you should never cross. And I don't think typically the European fans do that when you play over there. They kind of know when to kind of just shut up and let you play. And it's a tough environment, no doubt, but you don't need that, And I would say outside of that, the fans there were very partisan, which they should be. It's a home game. So it's supposed to be emotional, supposed to be great, supposed to be like a soccer match more than a golf match. So don't take away the emotion, but don't cross that line.
Yeah. The weather that week dampened their enthusiasm anyway, as I recall.
Well, missing putts always dampens the enthusiasm.
Tom, looking back at those images and just hearing the numbers associated with them, that's obviously the your entire winnings that year are sort of the first place prize most weeks on tour now. When we're in this sort of for-profit industry where the purses are going up, are you at all concerned that if something has to give, that it might actually be the charitable component that the tour looks at?
Yeah, I am concerned about that because you don't hear about it much anymore. There was a time when one of the things that the tour always pushed, nearly in front of everything else, was the charitable contributions to the communities and what a difference they've made and how it's more than all the other sports combined. And that was a leading line with the tour. You don't hear that nearly as much. Things are changing. But I do think that, the tour is in a state of flux, a state of change. They were here, they're going there. And I think all things will settle out. And I think the charitable part being such a big part of the tour that you will never lose that. I think it's going to be something that'll stick around forever.
Charity is important. Underdog stories are important as well. Did you consider yourself an underdog?
Oh, yeah. Oh, for certain. For a while.
Okay.
For a while. I think there's... Being from Minnesota, was a difficult place to grow up and get the experience you need. So always a bit of a chip on my shoulder, I think, because, as good as I thought that I was never, ever really put up against the likes of, the guys in my generation, Couples and Pavin and Norman, those guys like that, and had to kind of really earn that, and which is good. I mean, it's a good thing. So kind of coming up that way, having to earn it with a little bit of a chip, I think is a great way to learn how to become a really good golfer.
Year 2000, I went to the Old Course not to cover, I was a basketball writer, but to watch the Open Championship. And I'll never forget this moment. You hit your tee shot on Thursday. It's quiet, nice applause. And all of a sudden I heard, "Minnesota loves you, Tom." And you looked over to the gallery and smiled.
Yep.
How did your life change after winning that major championship in 96?
Yeah. I think by that point in time, that was an expectation that I was capable of that. I think there's always that ability to learn to believe, like, hey, what is my top end?
Yeah.
And somewhere along the line, I would say in about 93, early 94, I really kind of believed that my high end was major championship caliber.
Wow.
What do you think of the return? We see Brooks Koepka last week.
Yeah.
Torrey Pines, we're going to see him this week, a two-time former winner here. There's always sort of, I think, been a sentiment among the guys on the Champions Tour who've reacted to what's gone on in the game over the last few years as though the current generation of players see the tour as their asset to leverage as they please without paying attention to all the guys who built it before them. Do you sense that at all out there, that guys are just a little weary of everything being done to cater to the younger generation of players, and maybe the sense of legacy or tradition or what this tour has been over the years has diminished?
I think all you have to do is spend time with some of these young guys out here, and you know that's not true. The tour has changed, and it's gone past us. I mean, I called Tom Hoagie after he finished third in the Players' Championship a couple of years ago. I said, "Congratulations, you made more than I made in my entire season in 1996. Wow. You know, you finished third in 1 week. That was my entire, you know, my entire season earnings, and you did that in one tournament. So I look at that, and I know how great our life has been. I know how blessed we've been, and we don't want for a whole lot. You know, so I have zero envy, or I begrudge nothing to these young guys, because I think they're just unbelievable golfers. So you know, but it is a change. You know, it is a change, and you certainly hope that it doesn't become just about money.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, in the LIV Tour kind of, you know, that's, they made it all about money, and I think people are seeing that when it's all about money, nobody really cares in the end. I mean, it's like there's way more to it. And the PGA Tour, this is where it's at with the history, the legacy, the tradition, and all the intangibles that go with being a really great player out here. It's worth far more than just the dollars and cents.
Yeah. This week's about noise and shot making and handling your nerve. One thing we like to do at Golf Channel, we do the course tours where we take the drone and put it up high and give the folks at home an idea of what this golf course may play like. Let's start with the par 5 13th hole.
Yeah. This is where the golf course really gets to that point where you can make a big move. You know, you need a good tee shot. It's somewhat narrowish. You know, for TPC, the water really isn't play for these guys anymore. The bunkers in the desert are, but, you know, a good tee shot leaves you, I'm sure, an iron for most guys to the green. And it gives you a great chance, you know, for looking at three. I think when you get to the 13th hole, you really kind of think about hitting the gas and seeing how low you can go, starting right here.
This is, of course, where the crowd starts to really get into it as well. As you pointed out, that scoring difference now between the back nine these days versus in years past. Let's move on to the 14th hole.
The 14th has changed, you know, since when I was playing. It's far longer. Still kind of the same diagonal type tee shot. You know, you're hitting, you know, at a fairway that kind of bends to the left, and so it's how much down the left side can you take it to kind of get it out there for the shortest shot possible. So it really hasn't changed other than the distance. It's a lot longer today than it used to be. The hollows along the sides of the fairway are the ones where people can really get caught off, but I think most guys are hitting it beyond those hollows to the right, and for certain over the big hollow on the left. The desert on the left is probably more of a concern today than anything. But then the green is elevated. It's kind of way up in the air. It used to be way down below. Now it's, I'm not sure, 10 or 15 feet above the fairway. So you just have a hard time seeing exactly where the ball goes. The green tends to be a little bit firmer because it's up in the air like that. But again, it's mostly short irons. And I would say still a birdie hole.
How are the chipping surrounds?
Well, you can see I think they want the ball to get away from the green. Yeah. And you know, that's always, to me, when the greens are firm and the surrounds are firm, that's when the course plays its most difficult.
All right, we're going to move on over.
Then you get to 15.
Oh, my goodness, look at all that agua.
So, and you know, and the fairway actually is narrower than the actual width, because the whole left side tends to kind of run away off the edges. There's a little bit of slope that goes left, but then the ducks get out there, start eating all the grass, and they really take it down. So anything down the left side is probably going to get wet. But even still, it's a risk-reward par 5. It's a beautiful hole for that reason. It's a pretty big target. You know, I always aimed at the left edge of the green. Just try to hit it up the left edge of the green with like a 5-wood or a 4-iron or something. Just get it somewhere where I can putt. And if I can't putt, you know, give me a bunker shot. I think I'll take my chances there too.
A lot of dry land up there beyond that water.
Yep.
And then people will walk through the little tunnel, as Damon will later.
Oh, boy.
Into this crucible where the noise is going to build up. Just from a strategic standpoint, how would you play this hole, Tom? What advice would you give Damon?
You know, one thing about that hole, there's a number of golf holes on the tour where you're thinking about that hole before the round even starts. And this is one of them, 17 at Sawgrass being another, for example. And so it's in your mind all day. You hear the crowd screaming. And so when you kind of walk through that breezeway, you kind of come into I always call it the Coliseum. You know, you're the gladiator, and it's a Coliseum. And, you know, it's a really, really easy-looking shot. I mean, the green is fairly big. The hole isn't very long. It plays a little short, you know, for whatever the reason. You know, but the crowd is intimidating, and you have to be ready to pull the trigger and hit a shot. It's to me, one of the most fun golf holes in the world. It's like playing a golf hole in the Rose Bowl. There's nothing like it.
Love that. So after I birdie 16, we move over to the reachable, drivable Tom Weisskopf par 4 17th.
Yeah, and I would say that of all the modern architects, he may have been one of the best at the short holes. You know, because this hole right here, you can see on the left by the green, the water just kicks in a little bit from pinches from the left. It kind of slopes that way a little bit. So if you get it going down the left side of the green with any kind of a draw, that ball is going to get wet. The green itself is really big in the whole front portion, but that back left corner is wicked. I mean, it goes away. You can see how it's all shaved on the banks. There's no room for air to get it going sideways. You get it too hard, you're over the back down into the water. So it's really easy to leave a chip shot or a long putt, you know, 15, 20 feet short there. So that back left pin is brutal. It's really, really tough.
You're talking about a lot of things that could go wrong.
There's a lot of things that can go wrong, for sure.
These guys will then, if they survive this gauntlet, they move over to the 18th tee, which for most recreational golfers would look like a pretty intimidating shot, but not so much these days for these guys.
No, it's, you know, distance changes everything, and those pew bunkers down the left side, the church pew bunkers, you know, those are easily in reach. I mean, guys hit kind of down the left side of the fairway, the water's not in play for them. If you get it into the wind, it might be the fairway slopes right to left, but you see that it does pinch between the bunkers, you know, and then the church pews, you know, but all in all, it's a very short hole for these guys today. They're hitting, you know, wedges and of some kind. And so if you can put the ball in play, you know, it's an absolute birdie hole. So it kind of finishes the stretch of, if you can drive the ball in play, you can really take advantage of these last six holes.
Someone's going to be on that green 6 days from now making memories of a lifetime. When you look back at your lifetime competing at this venue, Tom, is there any particular moment or story that stands out after all these years?
There is actually one that's kind of funny. So I don't even know what year it was, but I was like 8 under through 17. I was having a really good round, and it got to the 18th hole and it was hurting from the right, the wind, and I just kind of overhooked my tee shot a bit and it bounce, 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 bounce. And it's like the last roll, it drops into the pond, you know, and I'm just so upset because of, like, you know, I'm playing so well. And so we go out there and, and you just kind of like, you know, stick your hand out to your caddy, you know, give me a ball. And he puts a ball in my hand. I stick it in my pocket. We're waiting for the guys ahead. And I walk up finally and I measure my two club lengths and put the tee down, take the ball out of my pocket, drop it. You know, the guys clear the green, get the yardage, get the club, go through the routine, get over the ball. And I look at the ball and I look at it. I played Titleist Tour Bolada back then. It's like, I see a Nike swoosh on that ball. Okay. So my caddy had taken a ball from the driving range and stuck it in his pocket, and he gave me that ball by accident. You know, so I put a Nike ball in play when I've been playing Titleist the whole day. So I'm thinking, oh, great. You know, a ball in the water. Now there's going to be a two-shot penalty for putting the wrong ball in play. Luckily for me, and really lucky for the caddy, you know, it was a correctable mistake. Picked it up, redropped the right ball, and moved on. But I'll never forget that moment. I was, you know, let's just say very unhappy with it.
I'm glad it landed swoosh up for you.
Yeah.
Lucky, yeah.
You're fiery, and I imagine still fiery. How much do you still enjoy competing? I talked to Ernie Els a couple of weeks ago. He just loves being out there with guys he competed against in his 20s.
Yeah, the Champions Tour is very relational, and Ernie is a very relational guy, and as much as he loves to compete and is great at players, I think he likes the relationships and the way where they've come through all these years. And I think that's the beauty of it. I mean, there's guys that you play against today who you played against as a junior golfer, you know, so for, you know, 50 plus years, you've been playing against some of these guys, and the relationships are pretty strong, but guys still work really hard. They care about winning. I remember asking Bernard Langer one time, like, why are you playing the Champions Tour? You're 55 years old, you're winning everything. You could still be winning out there in the tour, maybe. He simply said, I like to win. You know, guys like to win. They have a lot of chances when you're a good player out there.
Yeah. You're 66 years old now, Tom. You're playing, I would argue, a little bit more than a part-time schedule. You're playing 12, 14 a year. Do you still enjoy it as much as you did, or do you have a date in your mind where you're just going to kind of fade to black?
You know, I think the thing that I love most about golf and always have is that golf is one of those sports where it always gives you something to look forward to. There's always something ahead that you can't wait to go do. You can't wait to go play at St. Andrews in the Open. You can't wait to go play, you know, at Oakland Hills in the U.S. Open. You can't wait to go to Augusta. You can't wait to play here. There's always that thing ahead of you to look forward to. And it still is that way today. I look forward to going to Naples in 2 weeks. We have great friends there. I love Naples. You know, look forward to, you know, to go to Houston, you know, but a lot of it now has to do with, you know, the fact that I've made so many great friends over the years that you go and you stay with them and you have a great week with them and hopefully you play. But one last thing is that there's always that thing about golfers that the day you stop wanting to prepare is the day you should quit. You know, and I still love the preparation.